Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast. Hello and welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on a hard drive from Dublin and Belfast. When you look back at the Beatles' productive 1960s, certain years tend to get codified in a certain way. 1964, they take over America. 1969, they fall apart, but they leave us with Abbey Road. When you look a little closer in detail at certain bubbles of time, it can get more interesting. On a previous episode, we looked at the January 1970 session. Today, we're going back to the first few weeks of 1968. The macro view, the big view of 1968, is that they start to fragment in the process of delivering the White Album and on all things Apple-related. But the weeks at the start of 1968, before they head off to Rishikesh on the 15th of February, it paints a different picture, and that's the little area we're going to look at today. It doesn't really, that start of 1968 doesn't really tell you what 1968 is going to be, does it, Stephen?
No, it seems, for my money, it sits apart from the rest of the year. They're coming off sort of extreme highs and lows in 1967 with Pepper, with All You Need Is Love, with the death of Brian Epstein. The beginning of 68, they're very much involved with the Maharishi and meditation. They're planning their trip to India. And they seem to me, this is probably the last point at which they're all on the same page.
They're
all very focused. They've all completely bought in to one degree or another into transcendental meditation. They see this as the way forward, and that's their focus.
Yeah. And so let's look at the state of affairs right at the end of 67. Because again, this macro view of 67 was that, you know, they delivered the greatest album of all time, and then they have this tragedy. And then, whereas most people would take Christmas off, they're dealing with Magical Mystery Tour. So the last week of 67 is all Magical Mystery Tour business. The film, the TV film, gets shown on the BBC on the 26th of December, Boxing Day, as it's called in England. And it's pilloried. It's the first time that they're having to deal with a bit of fallout from that. And Paul is the person who takes the fall.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting to me. I mean, there's no denying that this was Paul's project, but it's interesting to me that he feels so badly stung by the criticism that the next day he's on the television proffering an explanation and a justification, and the other three are just well in the background and letting Paul take the fallout for that. But clearly they were very badly stung, Paul in particular.
He goes on the David Frost show, and what's interesting is, obviously, you know, at 6 o'clock on Boxing Day evening, Paul's getting ready for the show to go out on the television. He's not preparing to go on David Frost the next night. So it's obviously a very quick same day decision. And Frost brings him on the TV live that evening on the 27th. And he introduces him, which I think is quite interesting, as the man most responsible for Magical Mystery Tour. That it's saying this wasn't a Beatles film. This was a Paul thing. That's flagged from day one. It's a Paul thing.
Yes, that is interesting. And I wonder, is that Paul still 100% believing in this project and feeling, well, it's just misunderstood. It is a great piece of work. He's certainly the one that consistently has defended it over the years.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at Anthology, the others are a little bit kind of critical, and Ringo saying, oh, there's some good bits in it, and George kind of rolling his eyes a little bit. But Paul is the one consistently defending that. And I suppose if you think about it, with Epstein's death in August, they convened pretty quickly after that to start recording the remainder of the songs for Magical Mystery Tour. That's the point at which Paul is stepping up into that, maybe not quite managerial role, but he's certainly cheerleading for this particular project. And fair play to him. I mean, he takes ownership of it.
It is interesting that Magical Mystery Tour becomes very much a UK type thing. It doesn't get shown in the US. They have the record. So the other thing that's happening right at the end of 67 is that Hello Goodbye is number one in the UK. So 67 turns into 68. It gets to number one in America, if memory serves, just right at the start of 68. And the Magical Mystery Tour album is at number one at the start of 1968 in the US. So in some ways, you know, people are still just fans of the Beatles. They're not studying the psychodrama at the time. They're still putting out great records. And this, if you're trying to say, well, what was the view from the top of Beetle Mountain on the 1st of January 1968? There was no reason to think that despite all the problems they've had, it wouldn't be business as usual.
No, I mean, to that extent, you know, possibly there's too much focus on the critical failure of Magical Mystery Tour. You would imagine that sort of teenage Beatles fans or fans in their 20s or whatever will have quite enjoyed Magical Mystery Tour. It's the mainstream media, to coin a phrase, that don't like it. It's the mums and dads. And, you know, they've got number one album, they've got number one single. On the face of it, they're still absolutely sort of predominant in the charts. This is just a blip. And the fact that it was the first time the media turned against them, or the mainstream press and critics turned against them, that's perhaps more accurate than sort of saying, oh, it was universally reviled, it was a terrible, and as you say, it didn't get shown in America because of the press reaction in the UK. So the American fan base weren't affected in the same the same way. This is the point at which I think they start pulling away from that cross-generational appeal. I know this is something I kind of keep harping on about in terms of Pepper being the peak of that, but you know, this is the point at which the mums, the dads, suddenly I think I am the walrus. That's just a little bit too weird, and they start moving away. And at the same time, we've touched on this before, you have a whole new generation of fans coming up that are buying albums by the Monkees. This is not appealing to 10 and 11 year olds anymore. Yeah. So they're very much narrowing their fan base from that.
But it's like that quote from the Queen: "The Beatles have gotten awfully funny, haven't they?"
Yeah, yeah. So, but I think this is a natural sort of career progression.
Do you know what? We kind of think it's a natural career progression these days. I think the thing about that whole Magical Mystery Tour thing is that, you know, we wouldn't think twice now about a band putting out an hour's worth of vanity videos. You know, we wouldn't blink an eye at it. So part of the problem with Magical Mystery Tour is that people just didn't know, well, what is this thing? What are we supposed to, how are we supposed to imbibe it, and how is it supposed to entertain us?
Well, I suppose that's true. There's no template for this. There's no roadmap. And, you know, supposedly the BBC purchased it sight unseen.
Yeah. The BBC did champion it. They were happy to have it on the schedules, and it got the highest viewers that night in British telly.
Yes. Yeah. So by every sort of metric except the reviews in the press, it seems to have done quite well.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're still talking about it 50 years
ago. We could even do a whole show on Magical Mystery Tour. But we get to the January the 1st, 1968, and we've no sense of that the Beatles really have anything specific planned in terms of, you know, musically. We don't know of a whole lot of songs that are knocking around at this time. You know, the main goal is it's January the 1st. They're eventually deciding to go to Rishikesh in the middle of February. And there's a couple of things that need to be attended to in those couple of weeks. And I often feel that these weeks at the start of 68, there's still a sense of, you know, they're a Fab Four. There's still some fun stuff going on. They're still enjoying each other's company. I saw somebody on Twitter recently talk about, you know, that scene at the end of Magical Mystery Tour where they're walking down the steps, and how, you know, it's kind of like they're saying goodbye to that fun era of Beatles. But there's still a little bit of a hangover of that at the start of 68, where they're, you know, they're still that four-headed monster.
I think so. And the thing to remember is it was well known. I mean, it was publicly well known that they were heading off to India.
Yeah.
It was well known and had been very well publicized, not least by the Maharishi himself,
yeah,
that the Beatles were on board. The Beatles were sort of his disciples. John and George had been on the David Frost show. The Maharishi had sort of parlayed the connection with the Beatles onto a couple of fairly disastrous, it has to be said, appearances on the Johnny Carson show in America. So it was known that the Beatles had fallen under the spell of this sort of mystic, that they had announced that they were heading off. There was the publicity surrounding the fact of Epstein's death while they were in Wales, in Bangor, at that retreat. So it was, you know, it wasn't a secret that they had, that this was the focus. This is what they were doing. They publicly announced back in August that they'd given up drugs, you know.
Yeah.
So they were still acting, as you say, that four-headed beast. They were all together. They were all doing the same thing.
So let's look at January 68, and maybe we might break it down by Beatle, because the most productive or, you know, progressive Beatle at the time was George, probably, in January 68. He goes off to India before he goes off to India. He has his own trip on his own.
Yeah, he's making this trip to record music for the soundtrack of Wonderwall. And the interesting thing about this entire period from sort of late 67 through into the middle of 68 is that from 67 to 68 is that George is sort of setting the agenda. He has stepped up, and because of the Indian music, because of the Indian philosophy, he suddenly is, if not in a sort of a lead role, he's certainly setting the course. And he is undoubtedly the one who is most committed to the music and to the philosophy and to the meditation and religious aspect of it. So he's flying off to Bombay to do these initial recordings.
And he flies there on January the 7th, and he's recording between January the 9th and 13th. And there's actually film footage of this, some of these sessions.
There is, and you know, by all accounts, it's a pretty rudimentary studio. That there's traffic noise outside; they have to sort of accommodate that. He's recording Indian musicians. He's not sort of participating, except really as I wouldn't even say producer, possibly director, a musical director of what's going on. He's not, as far as I know, playing anything on these tracks.
And he's one of these backing tracks we'll come back to later, because one of them turns out to be The Inner Light gets recorded in Bombay. So George spends the guts of a week in India doing his recording sessions. The other Beatles, right at the start of 68, John is still living in Kenwood. He's still married to Cynthia, and oddly enough, his dad Freddie is in the picture around this time, isn't he?
Yes, so he sort of reconnected with his father. There are a couple of meetings. His father, by this stage, is going out with a much younger woman. At one point, they actually move into Kenwood in a sort of, I don't know, housekeeping sort of role. It's a very odd, you know, there's at least a podcast or two podcasts to be done about Lennon's relationship with his father during that period. And, you know, his father seems a slightly hapless character. You know, he just can't help messing things up in his relationship with Lennon. I think we were talking before we started recording about the Magical Mystery Tour party, where his father gets up on stage to do a turn, falls flat on his face, drunk. So it's not an easy relationship, even though at one point he's actually living in John's house.
Yeah, and so he does pop up in John's life between, correct me if I'm wrong, about 65 to 70, and eventually the end of 70, he post-Primal Scream, he tells him to get out of his life once and for all.
Very politely put, yeah.
Yes, he threatens to kill him. Anyway, peace and love. Anyway, so the other thing that's kind of bubbling around in the background in January 68 is Apple is kind of coalescing. There's a couple of little bits of Apple business, and the big formal launch for Apple comes later in May, post Rishikesh, and that's, you know, one of the big hang-ups of 1968. At the start of 68, it's existing on paper, and it's being kind of put together. So there's a couple of things. So I think isn't it Apple Films that starts in January?
Yep, there was a company, Beetle Films, and it changed its name to Apple Films.
Yeah,
and I think Apple Limited becomes Apple Core Limited.
I see what they did there. That's great.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's one of Paul's puns.
And they move
into. It's a good pun. It's a good pun. I like it.
It is a good pun. As a kid, I didn't realize the P was silent, so I was,
Apple Corps.
Yes, I was like, oh, it's Apple Corps. So yeah, Apple Films gets coalesced. Although Apple Films is listed at the end of Magical Mystery Tour, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they also move into their first Apple offices on the 22nd of January at 95 Wigmore Street.
Yes.
And you do kind of wonder how much the Beatles, I know they knew this was going on, but it's not like they were lifting boxes into Wigmore Street, This is all kind of happening in their name.
Yes. I mean, I think at this stage, it's very much the lawyers and the accountants, and this is a tax issue and a tax saving exercise. And it's I certainly couldn't say at this stage, I'm not aware at this stage that this is the plan or the roadmap for what Apple will be or what Apple will become is all laid out.
Yeah.
This is, they're just setting up the groundwork. They're sort of getting the legal structure in place. You can never have too many lawyers.
I tell you, they make the world go round, lawyers. In terms of trying to find group activity, on the 17th of January, John, Ringo and Paul, they're at the launch of a group called Grapefruit.
Yes.
What do we know about Grapefruit?
Grapefruit, they were signed, one of the Apple companies was Apple Publishing. And I think I'm right in saying that Grapefruit were the first sort of people signed up to Apple Publishing.
Yeah.
I'm not clear why, perhaps simply because the infrastructure wasn't there.
The thing I've read is that they didn't get signed to an Apple label because there wasn't an Apple label.
There wasn't,
they were just too early.
Yeah, they were just too early. So it's a publishing deal they have with Apple.
Yeah.
They signed to RCA Records, and there's a launch for the group, and John, Paul and Ringo are there. George is still in India. They're not, I think, a successful group. They don't go on to great things. They were named, I can't recall what they used to be called, but the name Grapefruit came from Yoko's book. So John renamed them Grapefruit.
That's interesting that's January 68, before John and Yoko or John and Yoko. It's probably the first bit of Yoko influence into the Beatles world that we can see.
Yeah.
That's like about 5 months before they become a couple.
Yeah. Well, supposedly.
Oh, right. Well, there's another podcast in that. it does make you think, though, like if the Beatles had stuck to just publishing, they could have made a fortune.
Absolutely.
Like, if they hadn't bothered with any of the fiddle-dee-dee, if they hadn't bothered making movies for Harry Nilsson or whatever, if they'd just done publishing, if they'd gotten James Taylor's publishing, they'd be wealthy. The Badfinger publishing, that would have made a lot of money. If they just focused on publishing, they could have been high on the hog.
But the point wasn't to get high on the hog. The point was to help people.
Yes. Western communism.
Western communism. That was the point. Here's another podcast. It's just about the history of Apple and all of the sort of acts, whether it's Mark Boland, David Bowie, Crosby, Stills and Nash, all of those acts that sort
got
of
away.
Slipped away that they didn't go with.
Yeah.
So whilst I could sort of mount a pretty strong argument to say that Apple was actually an extremely successful company in terms of records and chart success and number one singles and great albums, critically acclaimed albums. If you actually look at what they didn't do, and the opportunities that they missed, that's a fascinating kind of alternative universe. Yep.
And then towards the end of January 1968, one of my favorite things happens, which is on the 25th of January, they film, the four of them film the Yellow Submarine sequence, the sequence that happens right at the end of the Yellow Submarine cartoon.
Yes. Yeah.
And I love this. And I think this is the best example of, it's the four of them, they're being the Fab Four, they're being kind of funny and larking around, even though it's scripted to within an inch of its life, apparently. Mm. But it doesn't, when you think of the kind of the sort of dour image that 1968 generates, the seriousness of the White Album, this kind of larking around Beatles doing their I Have a Hole in My Pocket routine is very entertaining.
It's very funny. It's Ringo's a half a hole. It's this very deadpan delivery by Ringo, and then an equally deadpan delivery by Paul. A very kind of arch sort of. It's a very strange delivery.
Yeah.
And it's the fact that he sort of says, you know, what's the matter, John Love?
Yeah.
And it's such a kind of Liverpudlian or kind of working class. And in the background, you can see someone on Twitter did this where if you slow that up, you can see George sort of rolling his eyes at Paul's delivery. So
but you also see Paul trying not to laugh at John saying there's newer and bluer meanies, and
yes,
Paul is literally about to burst out laughing. It's
very funny. It's very spontaneous. It would be very interesting to know if that was like take 27, but it certainly,
yes,
you could sort of almost could see they just rocked up, did it one take, went home. It's hilarious.
It'd be lovely to see the rushes of that, and it's nice to see John being silly and glib. You know, you kind of miss, by the end of 68, you miss silly, glib John. Like, even the Hello Goodbye video when he's doing those kind of Elvis moves,
yes,
and he's linking arms with Paul and dancing around. You know, there's no harm in being silly.
No.
And that is something that seems to disappear out of him in 68 and 69.
I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. George too, you know, George becomes very serious all through 67 and into 68, and it's sort of with the Maharishi and the slightly hectoring tone that he adopts sometimes. Mm. John is off with Yoko doing art stuff. And yeah, the sort of silliness is missing.
So it's nice to see that kind of 1968 Beatles doing kind of a Hard Day's Night kind of routine. And if anyone's paying attention, in the sequence, Ringo has a moustache and John has mutton chops. That's the facial hair situation in that. If you're trying to track that out. So they do that on the 25th. Apparently that night, John and George go off to a fashion show by Ozzie Clark. And on 2 days later, John is interviewed at his home in Weybridge by Kenny Everett, and that gets put out about a week later on the BBC. But they are going to India, and this date is set in stone. And I'm going to guess Paul instigates the fact that, hey guys, we need to put out a single before we go away. And this is the crux of that early 1968 period, is that they go into the studio for a couple of days, and how that music is kind of set apart from the other music that they make later in 1968.
Yes, it sort of sits as a little discrete episode. You've got the sort of peak psychedelia of Sgt. Pepper and All You Need Is Love and Magical Mystery Tour, and then you've got the sort of hard rock and the sort of more grown up, I suppose, White Album, Hey Jude, etc. And this just sits in the middle. And as I say, people, the public knew that they were going to India.
Yeah.
The idea was it was going to be 10 weeks. It was going to be 3 months. They were going to be out of circulation for a long time. The Maharishi, his stated intention was, I'm going to make these guys fully qualified transcendental meditation teachers. And that's, you know, it's going to take 3 months to do that. And you could see Paul, you know, conscious of the PR, conscious of the keeping in front of the public, we've got to have product to sort of tide us over.
It is odd because they disappeared for a couple of months before. They disappeared between, you know, Revolver and Strawberry Fields. They disappeared, you know, they had disappeared for 3 or 4 months in the past and managed to get away with it. But what they've teed up is they tee up 6 sessions in Abbey Road. They plan 6 sessions between the 3rd of February and the 11th of February. So Saturday, the 3rd of February to Sunday, the 11th of February, to try and record a single for release while they're away in March. And parallel to the start of this, Ringo is prepping to go on the Cilla Black variety show.
Yes.
And he's doing a lot of rehearsals for that.
He's doing a lot of rehearsals for this during this period. So starting on the 1st of February, but across the sessions until the show actually airs, he is rehearsing. And what I hadn't realized until I started looking into this, his performance or his appearance on this show is the first solo musical performance by a Beatle.
Huh.
So individual Beatles have appeared, you know, being interviewed, or, you know, you had John appearing on the Peter Cook Dudley Moore show. But this is this will be the first musical performance.
Right.
By any one of the Beatles on their own. So I'm not sure, perhaps he was very conscious about this, perhaps just in the nature of the fact that you know, this was a variety show. There were going to be skits, there were going to be musical numbers, that it did require a lot of rehearsal. But it's interesting that he's the first one to go solo.
It is interesting. And also, he had, right at the end of 67, he'd gone off for about 10 days to film his first movie on his own. So he'd gone off and shot his scenes for the film Candy in December 67. And this kind of Cilla Black appearance, it's a bit of a nod towards what would come later with Sentimental Journey, because they're kind of performing standards, and also this notion of, you know, getting up in Liverpool in a pub and singing a song. I know he's also in skits and sketches and all the rest, but the music that they sing is very pre-rock and roll.
It is. He's not going to get up and sing With a Little Help from My Friend. You know, he's doing old music hall pub sing-along number and sort of a variety sketch. So yeah, it's absolutely prefigures Sentimental Journey.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So behind all of this, that show is due to go out on the 6th of February 68, live from the BBC Theatre, which is now the Shepherd's Bush Empire venue in London. And so he's rehearsing from the 1st up until the 6th to get ready for that. But session one that they all go into on, and Ringo is present, on the 3rd of February, is to try and dig out a new single. And what are the chances? Paul turns up with a single in his pocket called Lady Madonna.
Unbelievable.
What? Like, I mean, really, who could have surprised us? So this is his submission for a single. And it's still impressive at how quickly they get the guts of it down.
Yes. So this is a move away from that psychedelic phase. This is back to basics, rock and roll number. You record the basic track, Paul on piano, Ringo on drums. It's clearly a sort of boogie woogie Fats Domino. You know, Paul, I think, has described it at one point as being his Fats Domino impression.
Yeah.
And he also comments that it took his voice to a very odd place.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's maybe a step back, half a step back towards those early 60s Little Richard impressions. You know, it's back to a proper rock and roll voice.
Yeah. And at the time of recording this podcast, obviously it's the most recent thing we've heard from Paul, is him singing Lady Madonna in lockdown for that telethon.
Do you want me to do 10 minutes on that?
No, not really.
Okay.
But it's obviously a song that's close to his heart. And, you know, he often refers to the fact that, you know, his mum was a nurse, and it reminds him of motherhood. I know there's other parallel notions that the song might be about a prostitute or...
He's very clear that it was based on... And I'm conscious here of Paul is, you know... comes up with good stories and can kind of backdate things. But he's pretty consistently said, no, this was, he saw a copy of National Geographic.
Right.
With a woman on the front, a child at her feet. She's kind of holding a baby to her breast. And that's what sort of sparked the image in his head. People have said, done more research than I have. It's a January 1965 edition of National Geographic, if anybody has a copy out there. But yes, there's this on the website, in particular All Music, for example, in reviewing this song, they go into some considerable detail about this is clearly about a prostitute, that that each day is a new client coming along and being described, and it's a kind of blend of sexual and religious symbolism that could be interpreted. And I think this is just the worst.
There's a bit of glass onioning going on there.
There's a bit of glass onioning.
If we can introduce a new verb to proceedings.
Yeah, it's just I think over analyzing what's there. We know that the way Paul in particular I think works, he gets a phrase, he sees an image, and it just he just riffs on that. Yeah. The lyrics, he's
there is an interesting demo that's kind of popped up on YouTube, which is it's supposed to be a monitor feedback session of Paul playing the songs for the others. It's very brief; it's about 90 seconds. Have you heard this?
Yes.
And
I have heard that.
Where he's trying to, and it sounds legitimate that it's just like, you know, monitor recordings are when there's a tape running in the studio picking up what's happening, and he seems to be just outlining the arrangement to the others and doing ba-ba-bas and all the rest. Lady Madonna, that's a song I love, and it's great, and it, you know, I think it's interesting that it's the first song that also gets pulled out for Wings Over America, as in, here we are, here's a Beatles song, everybody. But
yes,
does it need to exist? And what I mean by that is, you know, there's an awful lot of progression in Beatles singles and albums, and Lady Madonna is kind of coming out to fill a void. It doesn't push things along the way Strawberry Fields does, the way you could argue that Hey Jude does. I don't know, does the Beatles story collapse with Lady Madonna taken away from it?
No, I don't think so. But what I think it does, I mean, it's a song I really like.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Yeah,
it's clearly a song that Paul likes. As you say, he played it in '76 on the Wings tour, and he pretty much trots it out.
Yeah,
consistently in his live show. What I would say is, it's drawing a line.
Yeah,
you know, it's a full stop on the psychedelic.
Yes,
excesses, and you can see that of all of the four of them, or perhaps excluding Ringo, Paul was probably the one who was least comfortable with the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Strawberry Fields, It's All Too Much, I Am the Walrus. You know, while George and John are putting out that type of material, Paul is coming up with these great melodic pop songs like Getting Better, even, you know, Your Mother Should Know. He is still mining that.
Well, I think it's interesting that I think you're right. I think it is kind of the start of this final phase, because we're sold this notion of, oh, you know, they stopped touring and they started using the studio as an instrument, and, you know, but we're kind of beyond that now. We're not using the studio as an instrument. We're just getting a song down, like the best song that you can get.
I think so. I mean, I think whether they consciously realize it or not, they've taken that studio exercise arguably as far as they could. And if you look at some of the groups that were sort of trailing in their wake and trying to do that studio based big conceptual pieces, it's almost a dead end until it sort of branches off into sort of prog proper. So it's almost that this is Paul saying enough is enough.
We're
closing the door to that. Anything that comes out after Lady Madonna, which is in the nature of kind of psychedelic or whatever, has been recorded before.
Yeah.
You know, so George has done his Indian recording in January. There are songs that sort of creep out later, but this is, I think, drawing a full stop. So in that sense, it's not so much that the Beatles story stops but I think it sends the Beatles story off in that direction, which sort of musically inevitably leads then to the White Album and to Let It Be. And
but for the rest of the songs they record in this session, there's still a bit of a hangover of 67 or psychedelia. So day two of sessions, Sunday the 4th of February, John arrives with his selection for what could be the next single, and that song is Across the Universe.
Yes.
And that's what they're recording on that day.
So they've actually done sort of two quick passes at that the day before, but this is but Sunday the 4th is the main sort of, this is the main focus.
And it kind of feels like a bit of a, you know, everyone loves Across the Universe, but there are so many different versions of it and mixes of it, except John.
Except John and Ian McDonald.
But it does feel like it never really got nailed down. It does feel like it never got nailed down the way it should have done.
Well, this has always been John's criticism of this, that he consistently has said, oh, I didn't get the support. You know, he said this in 1970, he said this in 1980. Paul was sort of sabotaging, has a tendency to sabotage my songs. But then he goes on to say, you know, the guitars are out of tune, my singing is out of tune. And you think, well, Paul didn't make you sing out of tune. This is still, you know, it's
still a witch.
It's not a psychedelic song. It's got the Jai Guru Deva Om thing. Yeah. It's that Indian vibe, but the arrangement, he clearly doesn't know what to do with it. And this is something that comes out if you look in Mark Lewison's recording sessions book, and if you read Ian MacDonald's Revolution in the Head. And I have to say, Ian MacDonald hates this song, absolutely hates this song. You know, he didn't know what to do with it. It starts off, it's an acoustic number, then it's got Indian instruments added to it, then it's got some backwards drums and bass added to it, then they all stand around a microphone and they hum a backing track for it. Lennon doesn't seem to have driven it forward.
But this is the dichotomy, isn't it? That Paul always arrives with the song in his head, and then Lennon arrives, and, you know, it's like, you know, make me sound like an orange shaking hands with a squirrel or whatever it is.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, Paul, as you said, with Lady Madonna, Paul has an arrangement. He has an idea. We should maybe mention here, it's that Humphrey Littleton song, Bad Penny Blues.
Right, that drives
from the 50s that Paul presumably has heard or has come back into his head. But he comes with the arrangement, and he knows what he wants. Lennon doesn't seem to know what he wants. He's very fond of the lyric. He, again, consistently, he subsequently is sort of saying, oh, it's one of my best lyrics.
But it's a lyric that's drawn from an argument with his wife, which isn't the most spiritual thing in the world.
I was thinking that it's sort of, you know, if you think, if you are Patty Boyd and you've inspired something and Layla and, you know, about how much your husband loves you, etc. And this is because Cynthia was droning on about something in his words, and words are flowing out, and it was such a pain. And so for such a sort of lyrical song or piece of poetry, it's very, very prosaic.
Yeah, very mundane origins. Yeah. So they kind of knock out a couple of different versions of Across the Universe on Sunday, the 4th of February. And then that's kind of, they press pause on that to tee up for the next session. So they take Monday off, and then on Tuesday, the 6th of February, they go back in, and this time it's George's turn to present a song. And Ringo is gone for the day doing the Cilla Black show, because that's going out live in the evening time. Yeah. And they spend most of the day working on The Inner Light, which a lot of the work is done on that already, because it's been done in Bombay.
Pretty much. You know, this is none of the Beatles sort of play on this. So this is recording the vocal.
Yeah.
John and Paul only appear right at the very end doing some harmony. So this is really trying to nail George's vocal. And again, the commentary on this is that George felt he'd left himself, it was too high a key for him, really, and he felt uncomfortable, and he had to be sort of encouraged by the other two to do this. This is a song that Paul has consistently said how much he likes.
I think it's a great song. I think it's the best of George's Indian sitar. I don't want to call them crossover songs, but you know what I mean. I think it's a fantastic song, and it's obviously almost completely solo George, but I do love that flash of John and Paul right at the end. It's like they're passengers on this journey, and they're behind him, literally.
Yes. No, it's one of my favorite George tracks. And the other piece of top pop fact that I discovered while looking at this is it was a number one hit in Australia.
The Inner Light was?
Technically.
Why technically?
It was listed on the chart. Someone who's listening in Australia can tell me what the Go Set national singles chart was, but it was listed with Lady Madonna as a double A side.
Right.
So technically, The Inner Light was a number one single in Australia, which I find very gratifying.
And it got to, it climbed into the bottom reaches of the Billboard 100 in 96 as well.
Can we say there are three officially released?
Okay, tell us about those
versions. So you have the mono single version. Yep. It was only released as mono, as the B side of Lady Madonna, and then a stereo mix was created in January 1970.
Right.
And Mark Lewison has said this is, you know, was done for some indefinable future use. There may be some suggestion that it was intended for the Hey Jude compilation that was being compiled.
Right.
But the opening section is different slightly. And that stereo mix was released on, as a bonus EP in the Beatles EP collection in 1981. And then on CD on Past Masters Volume 2. And then an alternative instrumental take appeared as a bonus track on Harrison's Wonderwall music, which everyone will have that. Everyone will have that.
Listen, I'm running to put my copy of it on now. But it's interesting that like I got to know The Inner Light through Past Masters Volume 2 at the end of the 80s. So that's a mix that was done in January 1970. That's interesting.
Yep.
And what's cute about this session is the Beatles take an hour off to watch Ringo on the telly. So they might have gone to either the Abbey Road canteen or to Paul's house to have a look at Ringo doing his thing with Cilla Black.
Can we just very briefly say that at one point, Ringo, Peter Brough was a ventriloquist in England, and his act dated back to the 50s, I think. He was a ventriloquist on the radio.
Of course.
So, so Ringo and Cilla Black duetted on the song Nellie Dean.
Yeah.
Where Cilla was the dummy sitting on Ringo's knee and while he drank a pint of beer. So,
right, okay, fair enough.
While the other three were recording The Inner Light. It's a nice contrast, I think.
And so then they do a little bit more work on Lady Madonna, and then that's that kind of session wrapped up.
Yes, this is where they got Ronnie Scott to come in and play. And he turned up with a couple of other musicians. They literally just phoned him and said, could you come down? This was after Paul and John had sort of done a sort of vocal arrangement imitating a sax sound. Ronnie Scott turns up and there's no music, there's no score for this. And I think Ian McDonald talks about this leads to a very exasperated solo from Ronnie Scott. And he describes it as a sort of lapse in professional etiquette on the part of Beatles. You just, you just come up and just play something. And this is, it's interesting because this is maybe the start of that, we'll just wing it.
Wing it in the studio.
You know, I mean, if you go onto the White Album, the guy that played the fiddle on the Ringo Starr track did a little bit of busking at the end. And suddenly he finds that's on the record.
Right.
So this is where they're saying, accidental things are fine, and little opportunistic recordings and things.
So that's interesting. And then they take Wednesday the 7th off, and then they're back in for session 4 on Thursday the 8th, and they're doing more work on Across the Universe that day. And like, was Across the Universe, do you think, really seriously in consideration for A-side at that time? Could it have crossed over? Because it's interesting that it obviously didn't get there, and they never really revisited it either later in the year.
No, it's hard to tell or hard to judge, because there are so many versions of this song kicking around now, and so many arrangements that you can read about in particularly in the Lewison book, where they're just trying and retrying, and you know, famously at one point they get two people in. Two girls from Apple Scruffs fans outside to come in, and we should name check Lizzie Bravo and Gaylene Peace, who come in. Suddenly Paul, you know, presumably sticks his head out the studio door and says, hey, could you come in and sing? Now, whether that's part of what John felt Paul was trying to sabotage the song, I don't know. But it's hard to tell whether this, I personally don't think this would have been a successful single. I mean, in the sense that, you know, it was the Beatles, it would have sold.
Yeah.
I don't think it stands comparison with Lady Madonna.
But it is interesting that it wasn't even pushed for a B-side. And you wonder, was it not pushed for a B-side on the logic that, well, The Inner Light was great, which it is, or was it not pushed for a B-side because, it's, you know, we just haven't nailed Across the Universe yet. We need to figure it out under pressure, and then they just never get back to it. It's odd.
I think the latter. I think it's just they collectively must have felt, look, we've just not nailed this.
Yeah.
You know, there's history here. There's songs dating from 65 that means a lot. If you think you've got troubles that they took a crack at and didn't feel they got it right. So they just abandon it and move on.
And so you talked there about there's a number of different versions of Across the Universe. And the first one kind of comes into fruition tonight because Spike Milligan is in the studio that night. And he'd actually been on the Scylla show with Ringo two nights before. But Spike sort of says, oh, this is a nice song. Can I have it for a charity album compilation that I'm doing?
Exactly.
And that's where it ends up initially.
Yes, so it finally, eventually, in January 9th, doesn't get released until 1969.
Right, the end of 69, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's the January 1969, they took the mono mix from February 68, and they added some effects, some birds flapping, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then it was remixed by Jeff Emmerich in October 69 as a stereo mix as well. So there's a lot kind of going on.
Yeah.
But that album doesn't come out until December 1969.
Yeah.
So they agree and they remix it in January 69, but it takes almost another 12 months before it comes out.
It is interesting. We get used to the notion of charity albums these days and charity singles and charity records. That must have been one of the first that it has a lead-off single from the Beatles. But it's an odd motley crew collection of people who are on that charity album. Nobody of the caliber of the Beatles, really.
No. I mean, it must have been. I don't know what the chart performance of that album was, or how much money it raised. It's just a sort of little footnote. That was first appearing on there. But if it's odd to think that all the way through the 1970s, most of the 80s, that version was just not.
Was lost.
It was not available.
Yeah, it only appears then at the end of the 80s on Past Masters. And again, that's the first version I knew. So that's that's a great version. Then the exact same recording gets turned into the Let It Be version. It just gets slowed down and orchestrated. Yeah. And then there's the same master again is the Let It Be Naked version, just without. So it's the same core recording, even though it sounds different. It's just slowed up, cleaned, put an orchestra on. And then there's two different alternate takes, one version on Anthology 2, which is actually probably the best one. White Album version.
The Anthology 2 one, I think, is the is my favorite version.
That's my go-to Across the Universe. And then another version yet again got stuck on to the end of the White Album reissue in 2018. So there's obviously a decision made around this time that, you know, whatever's going on with Across the Universe, it's not going on the single either on the A side or B side. And it kind of gets shelved. And then they take Friday the 9th of February off. They were due to do a session on Saturday the 10th of February, but they've already got an A and a B side in the bag, so they call it off, which is a pity. Would have been great if they'd managed to squeeze in something else, but they
need to step their game up, their work ethic.
They're just so lazy. But they have to, they probably would have cancelled the session on Sunday the 11th, only for the fact that a film crew was turning up.
Yeah.
And this is one of my favorite Beatles stories, that a film crew turns up to film the Beatles miming to Lady Madonna for a single. So it's amazing that 8 days after walking into a studio to record this song, they're filming a video because it's the deigned single. But then instead of recording a video, because they're the Beatles, they record a brand new song from scratch.
Yeah.
And that song is?
Hey Bulldog.
Hey Bulldog, which... Hey Bulldog is really interesting because it's sort of become this hugely popular song in the last 10, 15 years. It's really popped up on the Beatle radar an awful lot more than it did in the 80s or 90s.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I have a very clear memory of buying the Yellow Submarine soundtrack and just being bitterly disappointed by the fact that the second side was just instrumental music. I should say this is when I was about 14 or 15. But then you suddenly Hey Bulldog and you think this is one of the best songs they ever recorded. I just love this song.
Yeah.
And again, it's always described or has been described, oh, little known, or it's a sort of tucked away, but it is amazing that it has now become so popular.
Yeah. It's like obviously it's a great song. You wonder if it had been produced 8 days earlier, could it have been A-side material?
Yes. Is it a lost single?
I think it possibly is a lost single, or certainly Lady Madonna, Hey Bulldog is the lost double A-side single.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that would have been fantastic. Maybe it was,
I wondered by Sunday the 11th, had they decided The Inner Light was going to be the B-side, or would this have been too similar, sort of piano-based driving?
Well, I think that's why they would have gone well together, because what we were saying earlier on is that Lady Madonna is this kind of end of studio trickery. Hey Bulldog is the John take on that. It's like, oh, okay, you just want a rock song recorded well that's catchy and makes you want to dance. Here it is.
And
this
again,
is it.
That's interesting because this is John sort of, you know, we've had a couple of days of him struggling and not being able to get across the universe and not being able to get that kind of hippie trippy vibe that he's looking for to go with these lyrics.
Yep.
And then is this, as you say, a case of him just going, fine, that's it? And he comes up with that piano riff on the spot in the studio. So he comes in with the sort of demo that he's been working on for a while.
Well, yeah. I don't know at what point somebody said, let's record a song, but they pull out this You Can Talk to Me refrain that he's had about two or three years in his songwriting back pocket.
Yeah.
And between John and Paul, they just get this song knocked up together. John does the piano, you know, Paul links it up.
Is that the piano you played in studio?
Is that the one I played? I think it is.
It probably is.
Yeah, it is the one I played.
There you go.
Just
to remind everyone that you got to play
that
the piano.
I did that. It is extraordinarily amazing how fast that song gets produced. And they're being filmed while doing it.
Yes.
And the film does get edited into a Lady Madonna clip. But obviously, at no point in the Lady Madonna clip, and I'm assuming a lot of people listening here have seen it, do you see them miming Lady Madonna? They are recording Hey Bulldog. And let's have an argument about who's playing the solo on Hey Bulldog.
It's George.
You think it's George?
You think it's Paul?
I think it's Paul, because it sounds like Paul's, you know, taxman kind of heavy, you know, agitated solo.
It's George's Gibson SG standard guitar.
George on his SG. Okay.
Well, that certainly it's his guitar. I think the concession is because if you look at the clip, that guitar, and he's got that guitar.
He does, doesn't he?
The guitar. What I would say is it's a little bit reminds me a little bit of Clapton. In what Clapton was doing with Cream,
all right,
that kind of tone. And I'm trying to find a note, but I'm pretty certain that Jeff Emmerich, in his book, which I do not like, I'll take this. Yeah, I'm going to quote this. Paul's bass line was probably the most inventive of any he'd done since Pepper, and it was really well played.
Okay.
Harrison's solo was sparkling too, and then of course, he can't help himself, one of the few times that he nailed it right away.
Oh dear, that's not good. Okay.
His amp was turned up really loud, and he used one of his new fuzz boxes, which made his guitar absolutely scream. So I
think it's a screaming solo. I think it's a great solo. Yeah. But it does remind me of the, I know we talked about the Good Morning solo as well, which is cut from the same cloth. But what's interesting is, again, and it probably serves the afterlife of Hey Bulldog, is that it starts to get its modern day fame when the Yellow Submarine song track comes out in 1998.
Yes.
And what it's quite clever. They find in the summer of 99, they find the rushes or the footage of the Lady Madonna video. And through the appliance of science, they go back and recut this. And it's still a great video. They recut a Hey Bulldog video.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a great thing.
It's brilliantly done. It's brilliantly done. And amazing that they were able to recut it.
And it does feed into my thing of, you know, we have so little footage of the Beatles in 68. You know, we have the Yellow Submarine clip. We have this Lady Madonna, Hey Bulldog clip. And we have the David Frost clips where they're doing Hey Jude Revolution. You know, if only they had filmed the White Album instead of filming Let It Be, that'd be much more interesting.
Well, it's interesting that I was thinking that as you were saying, you know, they were making this up on the spot and they were being filmed. I mean, you compare that with exactly 12 months further on.
And they can't do anything.
They're being filmed and they can barely play.
Yeah.
You know, they seem so rusty.
Yeah.
But supposedly there are three different versions of that Hey Bulldog clip.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned with...
What are they?
Well, there's little bits... starts with Ringo on drums, and at the very end, Paul picks up his coat and leaves, which is from his Step Inside Love session.
Oh, Cilla Black.
Cilla Black.
Right.
There's another clip that features George for some reason eating baked beans. And then there's the edit for Anthology, which also contains some of the Hey Jude session.
Oh, right.
But can I also just say there are also five officially released versions of Hey Bulldog. You've got the Yellow Submarine soundtrack, which is a stereo version, and then a fold down mono mix. It's not a separate mono mix,
right?
But they use a different unreleased mono mix in the Mono Masters compilation. So that's where you would first have heard it, maybe.
Yeah, or I think I heard it on the Yellow Submarine album, probably.
Yeah. Then there's a new mix, new stereo mix, for the Yellow Submarine song track in 1999. And then a new stereo and 5.1 surround mix for the one DVD Blu-ray. So suddenly this obscure song tucked away suddenly ends up with five official.
There's probably a 5.1 mix on the Yellow Submarine DVD, isn't there? From 1990.
Yes, as part of there would be. Yeah,
there'd be one there as well. Mixes all over the place. Yeah. So Hey Bulldog, I'm sure everyone listening loves Hey Bulldog. So. It is interesting because that's the 11th of February, 1968. And, you know, it's 5 days later on the 15th of February, Thursday the 15th of February, that John and George head off to Rishikesh. So in the first few weeks of that year, they've kind of laid down a template that then sort of disappears. They've, they've shown that they are tight, fully functional, Fab Four, still... turning out the goods when they need to turn out the goods. And whatever happens in Rishikesh, it's different for the rest of the year, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think this is, I think, as you said at the beginning, it's a little sort of bubble of time.
Yeah.
It sits between the end of the psychedelic material that they're turning out. And it's a sort of half step towards the grown up material that's coming out in at the end of the year in the White Album.
So here's the million-dollar question. Did going to Rishikesh kind of ruin everything?
Good question.
sorry to put you on the spot there.
Yeah, is it the fact that they simply came up with so much material?
Yeah.
Part of the fact. I mean, I think if you look at what was happening at the very end of 1967 and the beginning of 1968 in terms of what their contemporaries, what their peer group were doing. So you have Dylan.
Yeah.
Dylan has released John Wesley Harding right at the end of 67. It's number one album in the UK at the beginning of 68. The Stones are coming back with Jumping Jack Flash. They're retreating from Satanic Majesties. I think everyone, those kind of rock royalty, are moving in that simplified direction.
Yeah.
They then churn out 30 songs. They have 30 songs to record, more than 30 songs to record. And it's just, perhaps it's the sheer volume that sends them off into different studios at different times, working on different things. If they'd come back from Rishikesh with a dozen songs.
Well, you know, Rishikesh and the White Album are discussions for another day, you know. But I certainly think we're at that point in 68 where, you know, there's this movement that music is for music's sake, you know. And as you say, move away from psychedelia, and that's kind of reflected all around. And when the cards were down, the Beatles delivered a bunch of great songs in 68, but there's that little window at the start of 68, and you sometimes wonder if there was a little bit of Fab Four jollity sprinkled throughout the rest of the year as much. Would we have been left in a different place? That's our look at the start of 1968. What do you think, people? Get in touch with us in all the usual places. We are on Twitter at Beatles Pod. If you go look for the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, Stephen will let you in and join us, and you can have a think about that start of 1968. We might put all the different versions of Across the Universe and Lady Madonna that we can find, and put up a playlist for that early 1968 period, and see what you think. But for now, thanks for listening. This has been Nothing Is Real. My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you the next time out. Thanks a million. This podcast is powered by Acast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.